Barebow Archery Podcast. Hit the X with the Barebow Archery Podcast.
On today's show of the Barebow Archery Podcast, we have Jes Lisgaard. He's a Danish archer shooting a longbow in 3D, and he's represented Denmark on the national team for 3D archery. Hi, Jes, how are you?
Hi, Glenn. I'm fine.
Good, good. Where are you today? What are you doing? What's the weather like?
I'm at my little tiny house. It's a tiny house I've been building here the last half year. I like the simplicity in living like this. So I've been building a little tiny house, and it's almost finished. So I'm in this little house here. Now I bought a little compound here for 2 years ago, and I've been building on it the last half year. So it's a very, very tiny. It's only 10 square meters, but it's really awesome to be here. Cool. And the sun is shining, and everything is perfect. And I have my archery lane just outside the door here.
Nice, so it's fun. Excellent.
Yeah.
Whereabouts are you? What country?
From Denmark, and I'm in the western part of Zealand, one of the islands we have in Denmark. It's the island where Copenhagen are situated as well.
Cool.
So it's about 100 kilometers from Copenhagen here.
And that's the capital for people outside of Europe that don't know.
But in Denmark, 100 kilometers are quite far. So it's quite far away from me to the capital.
Cool. And you were just telling me the sun's shining there. I mean, we're recording recording this in at the end of February in 2022. So sun's shining. Is it nice and warm?
Yeah, it's about, I think, 9-10 degrees outside, Celsius degrees outside now. So it's actually quite warm.
Excellent.
So quite warm for the time of year, actually.
Yeah, we had a really warm day. Was it yesterday or Friday was a really warm day as well. And I was just walking around in like almost in short sleeves. It was really unseasonal.
Yeah, but that's awesome. A little scaring, actually.
Yeah. Have you been affected by the winds? We've had quite a lot of storms here. We've had six storms in a row.
My house here and the little piece of land I have here is quite small, actually, but it's just outside the piece of land I have is some fields where the wind can blow quite heavily from west, and we have a lot of western wind here in Denmark. So this place is quite exposed for wind. But right now there's no wind at all. It's totally calm outside. So I really enjoyed these days here.
Cool, excellent. So let's find out a bit more about you in terms of your archery and what you do, how long you've been shooting, which class you're shooting, and what your kind of passions within archery are.
Yeah, actually I started as a kid with my granddad's longbow, where I was shooting with this very classic English longbow he had from I was about, I think, 7-8 years old, where we were allowed to shoot with it. And later on, I started in a little club in the place in the western part of Jutland, where I grew up. And it was target archery. And I just got, sorry to say, I just got bored with the target archery. So I bought a bow, a fiberglass recurve bow, and went. I grew up very nearby the very large forest in the western part of Jutland, and me and my brother we went stump shooting with these bows. So that was, I think that was where the basement or the base for my 3D archery actually was created. That was the stump shooting in these forests.
And is
And
that primarily what you do? Is that where your passion is in 3D archery?
yeah, I think I grew up in nature, and I have always have a passion for being in nature. I've been doing a lot of hiking throughout my whole life. And in Norway, the Alps, and on the Camino walk a couple of times as well. So the combination with the archery in nature, that was for me brilliant. And I had a gap where I didn't shoot, where I didn't do any kind of archery for about, I think, from I was 15 years or so, and until I was in the start of my 30s. I'm 55 now. In a week, actually, I'm 55.
Congratulations.
But
Happy
oh, thank
birthday.
you, thank you. But I had this kind of longing for the simplicity in the archery. I was teaching sea kayaking, and I've written a book about sea kayaking, and there was such a large amount of gear and kayaks and a lot of work with that. So I bought a longbow. I think I was 32 at that time, and the simplicity in the longbow just spoke to me. And yeah, that was actually where I was hooked, so to say. And I started in a club where I lived in this town where I lived, and there were some longbow shooters, and I was shooting with these guys, and I got such an amount of different ways of doing what I was doing. So I actually got more confused that than yeah, was necessary, I think. So I started myself to experiment and read a lot about longbow shooting, tuning the bow, whatever you can find on there. There wasn't a lot of YouTube at that time, but a lot of books and text, different texts, old texts, and I started to become more aware about how the longbow was working. And I could see that the Olympic recurve bows, they have a lot of practice and a lot of writings about what to do and how the bow works, and the mechanics in the bow and the mechanics in the body and so on. So I started to take some of these things because it's so similar to the longbow. Not totally similar, but quite similar.
So
So that was my start, and I am a little I had the passion, so I was shooting a lot at that time for the first, I think, 10, 15 years of my shooting career. I just enjoyed experimenting with the bow and the arrows and how to make it and how to tune stuff together.
just for a little bit of clarification, everywhere outside of the UK and maybe Japan and places like that, some places in Asia, the longbow is what in England they call the American flat bow, but
Yeah,
everywhere else
exactly.
they call it the longbow. So
Yeah.
you're shooting it's
I'm
a
shooting
wooden
an
bow.
American flat bow, but I have been shooting with a like classic longbow as well. But the American flat bow, where you have the arrow shelf and it's a little faster and so on. And when I started the 3D competitions quite early in my archery career, I realized that the precision of the American flat bow, which I call a long bow here in Denmark, was better, and it didn't break if something should happen with it. So I started to shoot with that because it was just more comfortable for me to shoot with.
I can completely understand. I mean, you're shooting wooden arrows as well
Yeah,
on that.
In the men's 3D longbow division, we are supposed to shoot with the wooden arrows. And I think there's the wooden arrows and the fiberglass or carbon fiber or aluminium arrows. The difference for me with the wooden arrows are like there's a little soul, a little personality in the wooden arrows. They're not quite as good as the carbon arrows, but I like the personality in it. And you can drag a little history into the flat bow with the fiberglass and carbon fiber in it with these wooden arrows. So I like actually shooting with these wooden arrows.
Cool. So you kind of take off your shooting and you progress and you get better and better,
Yeah.
and you get up to a level where you can, go to competitions. This is, are you predominantly World Archery? Do you shoot the IFAA as well?
Yeah,
Or yeah.
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
There's slightly different rules between the WA and the IFAA in terms of the way that when you, the bow's strung, that the there's no reflex. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. In the World Archery Association, you're not allowed to have a slight reflex in the longbow. It has to be like straight in the limbs, so there's no curve backwards in the limbs.
Right. And apart from that, what about the center shot? Are you allowed cut past center, or does it have to be
Yeah,
dead on center?
you are, as far as I know, most modern longbows are very close to center shot,
And in
and
terms of the arrows themselves, do you have to kind of go for traditional points and feathers? Are you kind of stuck with that, or can you adapt to put, say, a pin knock in and an adjustable?
I'm not quite sure if you are allowed to shoot with plastic feathers, but I have not seen any in the longbow division do it.
Right.
So I suppose that it's not legal to shoot with the plastic feathers.
Yeah,
So it's natural feathers, and you have these points, the field points on the arrows.
and because I've got some trad veins, I've still not put them on, but apparently you can shoot off the shelf with the trad veins. They will, they fly pretty much the same. Like I say, I've
Yeah.
not tried them. I don't shoot off the shelf. I had a brief a brief
Okay.
experiment with shooting off the shelf, but there were other things going on, and I was like, no, this is an experiment.
Yeah.
It's not the right time to be doing this experiment.
No.
So.
I think with the natural feathers, it's only a problem when it's very moisty and rainy,
Yeah.
because they get really wet, and they don't correct the arrow in the air as
Yeah.
good as when they're dry, and they get a little heavier, so you get a slightly heavier spine on the arrows as well. So a lot
Yeah.
of stuff goes on with the natural feathers.
Cool. So we've gotten a little bit of background about who you are and how you got into archery and
Yeah.
what kind of what bow class you shoot. And you've obviously progressed and you went on and shot for the national team.
Yeah, I've been on the Danish national team for 10 years. I've been participating in the European Championship and the World Championship for 8 times, I think 4 times each. And in 2012, I got a third place at the European Championship in Croatia. And that was
Cool.
my first championship I participated in international like that. So that was and I was the first person in the longbow division in Denmark to receive a medal.
Oh, excellent. Well done.
So that was quite nice actually to have that experience with me.
Excellent.
And that was the year I have been written a book about or 3 books actually. Now about archery, and shooting with the longbow and tuning it. And the latest one about target panic or archer's reflex, as I prefer to call it.
Yeah, that
but
was a nice
your first...
segue into the next the
yeah,
next part of the discussion.
Yeah. And these books actually occurred because I was, when I started, as I mentioned before, I was so confused actually about all these different types of personal descriptions of how to do this and how to do that with the bow, that I actually couldn't use anything of it because it just got very confused and messed up if I did what one person said it might work a little, and then it was contradictory to what another person said. So I started to write a little, and it became a book, a 200-page book about how to shoot and how to tune your bow, and some anecdotes with my own stories about my way in archery, actually.
Cool. Is that
and,
available just in Danish, or is that in English as well?
Yeah, it's just it just sold out there a couple of years from the publisher, and they won't reprint it. So I started to rewrite a new edition on it, and it became a new book. So I'm almost I've almost finished the text with that one.
Oh, cool. Cool.
And I'm making some drawings, and I'm going to take new pictures and so on, because a lot of new stuff. I get wiser, luckily. So a lot of new stuff. A lot of new stuff occurred to me during these years, especially from my competition experience. So I have brought a lot of these things into the new book, and I hope it will be translated into English and German. The latest book about target panic or archer's reflex have been translated into German, and it is translated into English, but the publisher, Angelika Hönig in Germany, haven't printed it yet in English. I hope she will do that soon.
Oh, cool. We'll get onto the book and where to find it, and hopefully we can raise the profile of it in terms of like the English speaking people, and if they want to go out and get it, and they should hopefully by then know where to find it. So
cool.
Clearly at some point you've had this kind of passion that's gone on for a long time, and you've got to a level where you've represented your country at European and international level. And then the reason that I came across you was I think somebody mentioned to me, I was having a bit of a, it wasn't so much a drop in form. My shooting had literally gone off the edge of a cliff. Somebody mentioned, oh, I'm following this guy. He's on YouTube. Go and take a look. And I was really fascinated by your approach, because it was similar to one that I'd seen from, I'm going to forget what the guy's called now.
Fair enough.
Oh no, that's going to annoy me. I should have written it down and done a bit more research. I've got the book. It's sat upstairs in the bedroom. Instinctive Archery Insights. Jay Kidwell. He's some kind of college professor at a college in the US, and he's a psychologist, and he says this is a learned response. This, you know, the things that happen to you when it's not going so well, these are learned responses, and it's just a case of kind of unpicking them, or reprogramming yourself. And when I watched you've got a YouTube channel, just give us a shout as to where people can find you on YouTube.
Yeah, I have the YouTube channel. It's just my name, actually. Yes, Lyskov, J-E-S, and L-Y, S-G-A-A-R-D, Lyskov, is it pronounced in Danish? So my the YouTube channel is my name, actually.
And if they search for Archer's Reflex, on YouTube. Yeah, they should find you, shouldn't they?
Yeah, I suppose so. It's one of the search words.
Yeah, I think that's how I came across you. Although the guy called Hamish gave me your name. I think he's called Hamish Boyd. Okay. He gave me your name, so that kind of led me to your channel, and then just watching the videos. I watched the presentation you did. I think it was a German kind of archery exhibition somewhere.
Exactly. Was in Paderborn in Germany. Where I've been a couple of times and make a speech about the Archer's Reflex and the book as well.
So everyone's dying to know what Archer's Reflex is. I know what it is.
it actually occurred because I was I'm an educated bachelor psychologist and hypnosis therapist, and I have been. Body therapist as well as with an education there. So I was quite. I hate this word target panic because for me it has nothing to do with panic.
Yeah.
So I tried to find
a word. It is a horrible. In archery, there seems to me there seem like, and there was a debate on another podcast about it the other day. There seem to be a lot of words and phrases used that just don't really seem appropriate. I don't know where they've kind of come from, where that terminology, but it seems to have been there a long time. Target panic, that's one of them. You know, parts of your shot process where, you know, you need to do this, and they call it, you know, back tension. Well, that to me sounds like you're tensing your back. I mean, that putting tension in muscles is the last thing you want to do in any kind of, you know,
you're so right.
That if you were to go to someone and say you need some tension there to like a sporting coach at a high level, they just laugh at you. You know, expansion's another one. And I was listening to a podcast the other day, and it says it's like, you know, expansion. You need to expand at the back end, and it's like, well. They were saying, look, it just sounds like you need to basically tear your shoulder out of its joint and like pull really hard with your hand. And it's like, that's not the movement. A lot of the terminology is not really representative.
No, they're not appropriate. For what they actually are going to say. So I tried to rename this target panic and found out that all archers I have seen now for my whole archery career have the archer's reflex, and they create some kind of reflex. Some personalities, some people are a little better to suppress this reflex than others, and I think that has to do with the personality actually. And the way you deal with life overall. So I found out that this Archer's Reflex was more suitable for me, but I need to address it as target panic as well, because no one knows this new word, Archer's Reflex, as I described.
And people would need to, I think people would need to reference your videos on this, because it's quite, it's involved with kind of the way that the brain works, the way that your body and your mind learns, as well as the kind of visual and physical inputs to the brain. So I would ask, you know, if you want to pause the podcast, because I remember somebody complaining that our podcast was too long, and it's like, you don't have to listen to it all at once. You can listen to it in bits when you've got the time. It's not like watching a film at the cinema. You can actually get up and stop, press pause. So if anyone wants to press pause and go over to Yes's YouTube channel and have a look, because he's got like a whiteboard there, and he kind of explains where he's coming from with this in terms of, you know, how the brain actually works, how you learn things, you know, because when we drive a car, when we do kind of manual tasks that we've done before, a lot of that kind of becomes automated, doesn't it? It's not something that you consciously think about. And when you actually consciously think while you're doing it, you can interrupt that, but you can also have tasks that a completely automatic response isn't necessarily the best thing for that task.
Exactly.
So if you, I mean, you're the expert, you're the guy that's studied this at, you know, bachelor's degree level, and you're a practitioner within that. I mean, we had Adam Cowming from Archery Mental Mastery, and he was kind of talking a little bit about, you know, the way that the brain works and stuff like that. And I was really interested when what I saw on your YouTube channel really chimed with what Jay Kidwell put in his book. And his book, it was only kind of an afterthought, because it was it'd been in print a few times, and then somebody must have said, look, can you do a thing about the dreaded target panic? And this podcast, this whole, you know, the Bear Bow Archery podcast is not just about, you know, target panic, although it does seem like it. But he was saying, and it's an experiment that was done quite a long time ago by a guy called Pavlov, and people will have maybe heard of Pavlov's dogs, the experiment where you initiate a response with a stimulant, and then you can associate that stimulation with something else that's not really related, and then you can remove the stimulant, use the non-related cue, and get the same response as you did before. And that's something
that was just a saliva creation in about the year.
Yeah,
with the dogs.
So he was doing an experiment where he had meat powder and he had dogs, and he would have like a some kind of blower thing, and he would blow the meat powder in like into the dogs' mouths. They would salivate. Yeah. But then at the same time he rang a little bell, didn't he?
Yeah, that was quite a good explanation of his experiment.
Yeah, and then what he did was he removed the meat powder, which was the thing that was actually causing the dogs to salivate. Yeah. Yeah. But then he rang the bell, and the dogs salivated because they associated the ringing of the bell with the meat powder kind of coming next. So the dogs reacted in like a programmed way, and he kind of he showed in that experiment that animals and humans can be programmed by a conditioning.
Yeah,
you
it
know,
was. I think it was the first to describe these conditionized reflexes. Actually.
Yeah. So when you discuss it, when you're kind of describing Archer's reflex, like I say, go over to the YouTube. There's three videos on there. There's more than three videos. There's videos as well about, you know, shooting and 3D and shooting the longbow. And then there's a big presentation at the, is it Paderborn? Is that, am I correct?
Yeah, Paderborn in the middle of Germany, I think.
But your explanation in your term, the archer's reflex, it's how that kind of conditioning applies to archery, because it's a sport or a pastime or a hobby that's got a repetitive nature in it, and you could quite easily program yourself in the wrong way. So you're the expert, you're the guy with the psychology knowledge, so I'll hand over to you to kind of fill in all the blanks.
I was quite fascinated when I started to research this phenomenon, actually, to find out, and I didn't know that before, to find out that we only need to make about 28 movements before we have created an automatized movement, actually. So it's not just for skilled archers. All people who start to create the same movements, they build up this reflex in a way.
So you don't need to do it that many times, and then it's you kind of, if you've learned something the wrong way, or you've made an association that's not necessarily a positive association, it only takes, you know, 28 shot
movements.
28 attempts to kind of ingrain that, and that could be a negative thing. So I think one of the common things that people seem to do is they associate the pin in the sight or the tip of the arrow going towards or being in the general area of the target or the gold or the 11 ring or whatever kind of target you're shooting at, and that becomes the trigger for the arrow to go before they're ready, or they don't even get the arrows, because you talk about there's a generalization that your brain can't remember every movement, so it kind of makes a generalization of and it sums all those together and says, well, this is kind of the approximate reference.
The American psychologist Daniel Stern, he have this RIG as he shorten it to a representation of an internalized representation. And it means that when we see a lot of the same things, almost the same things, or receive a lot of impulses that are almost the same, we store it in the brain as a representation of these things. So it's a kind of an average of all these imprints you get, or visual imprints. To stay in the archery terms, visual imprints from your sight picture. But none of these visual imprints are exactly the same, but they are so close to be the same that we cannot we can't see the difference of these imprints. So we store it as just as one imprint. And when we raise the bow and we get the sight picture, the brain starts to be affected by the average of all these imprints we have done before, and because of the brain's ability to optimize itself and the thinking and the movements, we start to use these imprints that might be slightly different or different from the right sight picture. Then it starts to be our trigger impulse, and that was actually quite interesting to use that theory to describe what is actually happening when we get these visual imprints or inputs from the sight picture.
You're listening to the Bad Boy Archery Podcast. Don't touch that dial.
So essentially, you know, because archery is a repetition sport, it's something where, you know, some people might, you know, people who've got plenty of time on their hands might shoot 300-500 arrows in a day. That's a lot of imprint. So clearly, if you're doing that day in, day out, week in, week out, and you've had quite a long career, or you know, you've been shooting archery for a long time, your brain can't remember every single one. And like you say,
it makes
a representation, and that could that just be like one image in your brain that's basically all of those sight pictures that you've ever seen reduced to an average, and it's that one image. Is that essentially what am I getting the right?
That's quite a good description.
And
when you have these sight pictures, and I'm have been a little in a storm sometimes, because I claim that there's such a thing as instinctive, purely instinctive archery doesn't exist as long as we have
I'm just waiting for the hate mail to roll in.
As long as you have your arrow knocked the same place and you have a solid anchor point in your face, and you try to draw your arrow exactly the same way, then you will, conscious or subconsciously, be affected by the sight picture you have. And I have tried so many times now to give one of these persons who claim that they only look at the target, they don't see the arrow, that they shoot purely instinctive, to give them an arrow that is a little longer, a little heavier, whatever, and they can't hit. So for me, that shows that they actually use their side picture. It might be subconscious, subconsciously they use it, but they use their side picture to create the right sensation of the shot they are going to do.
Could they also use the arrow trajectory so that subconsciously they've seen the arrow fly, or even consciously they've seen the arrow fly, and then that becomes another thing?
Some people claim to do that, but you might be able to do it, in my opinion, with a very weak longbow, where the arrow flies so slowly that you are able to see it. But when we have the modern longbows, I shoot with a 43-pound longbow, and even at that poundage, the arrow moves so fast, so it's quite difficult to see it from the behind. If you are looking at it from the side way, you can see it.
Right, yeah.
But from the behind way, you only see the back part of the arrow. I believe that the trajectory is quite difficult to use, so I'm not sure that these people are right if we look at it scientifically.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying not to get drawn into the instinctive archery debate, but one thing they always reference is, oh, you know, you can throw a ball, you can just see something, you don't measure the distance, you just throw a ball and it kind of gets there. That's a learned response, because if anyone's ever had small children and watched them throw balls from like the age of say 2 or 3, once they kind of got the motor skills to kind of hold the ball, and then when they try and throw, they don't fall because they're off balance or whatever. But when they do it, I mean, the ball goes straight up in the air. It goes behind them. It goes right in front of them, and they're looking at what they want to hit.
Yeah,
but they don't have the motor to control, and they don't understand.
No, exactly.
They don't have the feel of the weight of that ball. And if they could learn how to throw that ball, and then, you know, like you were saying with the arrow, you swap the ball, and then all of a sudden the ball's not going there anymore. And then they throw it a few times, and then they learn that, oh, this ball's heavier, or this ball's lighter, or this ball's bigger. You know, it's got more.
And I think My description of their instinctive archery is that when you have, just like if you're a musician who play on an instrument, you can't play Bach or Beethoven the first time you place yourself in front of a piano.
Yeah.
But when you have learned the keys and you have learned how this instrument works, and you know exactly when you press your fingers with this amount of weight on one of the keys, you start to be so familiar with what you're doing, and you have created some kind of instinctive intuitive way of doing this you're doing. And then I think when you have done it consciously a lot of times, then you can switch over and you don't have to think about what you're doing, and then you shoot instinctively.
Cool. You mentioned as you know, in your archer's reflex, you were saying it's a reaction to a stimulus, and a lot of people the stimulus is just, you know, the tip of the arrow for kind of unsighted archers, or the pin in the sight getting close to. I mean, some people get locked off, they're underneath, they're above, they're left and right. Some people can't get to full draw, they can't get to anchor, and the arrow's gone. Is that their reflex just becoming, you know, because you have this thing called TAB, which is I think it's called TAB.
The TAB, the target anchor back. It's a visualization, basically.
And you have the barcode as well. You have the barcode where, you know, like on a barcode, there's thick black stripes followed by thin white lines,
exactly.
and then some of the black stripes get smaller,
I have this. It's actually Martin Ottesen who have inspired me to this barcode thinking.
Yeah.
You have interviewed him in one of your previous podcasts.
Yeah.
But when you're the target panic or arches reflex have many faces, I believe, the many ways of showing that you have this reflex. But if you are in your start position with your bow and arrow knocked, and you are about to make a short cycle, in the start you are able to stop the short cycle. But the closer you get to this very point where this reflex are activated, the more difficult it becomes to stop it or to control it. And I described that with this barcode picture. If you see a barcode with quite a distance between the first lines and closer and closer and closer, then the closer you get to the very point where this reflex are activated, then you enter the red zone, or I think Joel Turner called it the storm. And this red zone, in this red zone, your reflex will take over your conscious part of the brain that are able to consciously, how to say it in English, consciously are affecting the muscles.
Yeah. So
the reflex takes over there, and you're not able to control it anymore. And if your sight picture, the thing that trigger your release impulse, then you will release when you enter this red zone, and it might be the wrong sight picture. Quite often, it's the wrong sight picture, and as long as you try to suppress this reflex, then it's scientifically proved now that that your conscious mind are about half a second delayed from your reflex mind, and you can see it as I think I mentioned in the speech I make. If you drop a glass of water or whatever from a table, you quite often are able to grab it before it hit the floor, and that's the reflex. But if you were supposed to think about that movement where you are going to grab this this glass which are falling down, then it will crash the floor before you even are activating the muscles, right?
Yeah, understand that.
So the conscious part of your mind in this reflex tries to get control over a reflex that actually have started half a second before you are able to control it, and that creates in the motor cortex in the brain, that creates two opposite impulses, where one impulse from the conscious mind say hold the arrow, and the other one from the reflex from the cerebellum, the old part of the brain, say release. And these two impulses cannot be delivered to the muscles without creating some very strange movements, or you can't release the arrow, you can't get up into the anchor point, or whatever phase this reflex have for you. So that's a scientific explanation of what actually is going on in the brain. In broad headlines,
there's quite a lot of the time, Joel Turner mentions this on his course, and a few other people I've spoken to, like Martin Ottson, have kind of alluded to it as well, that there needs to be a separation from the sight picture to the thing that in your brain says, okay, it's time to go, let's release, let's relax the fingers, and or, you know, initiate whatever movement that you need to do on a release. And there needs to be the if we're working back towards the Pavlov's dog, there needs to be something that breaks the link between the bell going off and the dog's, you know, foaming at the mouth for the meat powder.
Yeah, exactly.
So
the problem, the problem is here that that when you have created a reflex, this memory path to the reflex will be in your brain for the rest of your life. So so you're like a thief in the night. It will, this reflex will be affected by almost nothing.
Yeah.
If you haven't, if you haven't, you can't decode it, but you can suppress it. And in that term, decode it, but you can suppress it by creating a new reflex that are stronger than the old reflex. But you will have this memory path to this to the bad reflex for the rest of your life. So so it will be affected. And I've written about this. A lot of people, when they are into a competition, they get nervous. The adrenaline level raise a little, and when the adrenaline level are getting a little bit up in the body, this reflex parts are increased like hell. Sorry, my words. This reflex part are increased quite a lot. So it takes a lot more effort to be conscious to suppress this reflex when your adrenaline level are high. And that is why you, you see a lot of archers who are actually are extremely precise, and they are doing their shot cycle perfectly in a training situation. And then the day after in the competition, they can't shoot.
Yeah.
Or they can't hit, at least. So that's because of this of this adrenaline level. And then suddenly, I think it's Joel Turner who says as well that you are another person when you are into a competition. And this other person, I believe it's is still me who are in the competition, but I'm just affected by adrenaline more than in my training situation. So so this adrenaline, I need to learn how to cope with that. And I haven't still found a way to increase my adrenaline level in training situations. So I need to go to a competition to practice that part. And as you probably know, it's quite difficult to participate in a competition just for practicing.
Yeah, yeah. It's expensive to go to a competition. It takes up a lot of time. So
yeah,
I've just started doing it. It's been something I've been thinking about for maybe a year or two. There's a thing called Archery Abroad. And it's just, it's an online competition. You're not shooting many arrows, but that kind of puts a bit more pressure on you because you've got 18 arrows and that's it. It's not like you can have a bad end or a couple of bad ends on a 60 arrow or a, you know, a 24 target, you know, World Archery 3D shoot. So you've got your 18 arrows and it's all either live online or, you know, you're recording it and you have to post it up so that everyone else can look at it. So there's a little bit of increased pressure there. But like you say, I mean, people say you need to kind of, and I've heard this again on other podcasts, that, you know, there's some quite good ones for like non-sighted kind of single string shooting, the Push podcast and the Barebow Project podcast. And you know, they talk about having, you know, exercising your competition callus, getting your, you know, getting your competition brain, you know, ready by going and competing, doing online archery things, even just simple things like, you know, putting a training session that you do Facebook Live it so that everyone can see it, just to, just so, if you're making mistakes, people are looking at it and you kind of, that gets into your brain and then it's dealing with that little bit of extra tension. But just going back to the fact that it you know, it's scientifically proven that it only takes 28 shots to kind of program yourself this way. What kind of, you know, unlike, and the other thing you said, look, once you get programmed like this, that you've got it for life. You've got it for life. You can write another program over the top that needs to be stronger, but then when you get in a competition situation, you know,
I think that one of the ways of dealing with it is to practice so much that you have a very, very strong rhythm or very strong routine, and you can fall back to that strong rhythm and strong routine you have when you are in a competition. And yeah. Sometimes it just everything falls apart, and then it's quite difficult to pull yourself up again. But if you have a strong routine, it's possible to come back. But when things fall apart for you in a competition, most people, probably not all, but most people, they will have an increased adrenaline level just because of it's falling apart. So that will even increase your falling apart. So it will be a very negative spiral you are getting into. My advice for myself and these people who experience that is that practice so much with the right routine that when you are in a competition, you are not going to do anything different from that routine, because that's your kind of anchor point for your shot cycle.
That's where I have been coming unstuck recently, where I have a shot routine and then there's always this little voice in the back of my head that says, oh, let's maybe try this, let's maybe try that.
Yeah.
And then it becomes a constantly changing, constantly evolving.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's never, the only constant is change. There's no actual point where it stays the same. And I'm quite interested in like sports psychology. I had a guy on who was he kind of coached top. He's basically like a mental coach for top sports people, business people. I've had people on to talk about like who were, you know, high flying businessmen who then started archery, and they talked about their troubles and like kind of getting their process back together, getting their kind of competition game back together, where they just couldn't transfer anything from practice into competition. And I've been reading things, books, and they're not necessarily archery books, by a guy called Fred Schumacher, who's like, is it Extraordinary Golf or something like that? I can't remember.
Yeah.
And Tim Galloway as well. But just on the issue of coaching, if it only takes 28 shots and you're somebody who is new and it's not something you need to have done for years and years and years, are we teaching people in archery when they're coming into archery, we're sticking them in front of a target and saying, hit the gold, hit the gold, hit the gold?
Yeah, I think it's wrong. When I teach, I have some teams I teach in archery, both beginners and elite shooters. But I think it's very wrong to place a target face on the target that first day, or even at the first month. But people tend to be so eager to have something to hit with the arrow, that they quite often are asking for this face to shoot at. But I think it's actually a wrong approach to do that, because you need to learn your body and your muscle memories and you need to know the technique before you start to focus on a target.
Do you think that's the way a lot of people have kind of gone wrong, and it's that early stages have kind of harmed their development?
I think it's one of the things, but when you are shooting a bare bow or long bow, that's the same for me. When you are aiming, you don't have your clicker, you don't have all these external devices on the bow to tell you when you have reached full draw, when you are going to release the arrow, and we need to, except if we use some of the alternatives and others external clickers like the thumb or the feather to nose technique, And if you're not using these, you need to be so aware about your body and your muscles, so you don't shrink or you don't draw a little longer and release at the right time and so on. So we need to be extremely aware about our body and how it works. And if you are a beginner and you enter an archery club and you start shooting on this target, you are you will, as a trainer, take away this way of feeling your body from the new archer.
Yeah.
Does it make sense?
Yeah. Oh, no, it totally makes sense.
Yeah.
The reason I went back to it, you know, if it's only 28 shots, that can be an equivalent to, say, like the first lesson. So you could be learning the wrong associations, getting the wrong kind of cues from
very easily
from the first lesson. Because I was again, like, going back to the terminology, this is a way that they put a big target up and they stand relatively close, but then you're still making that association with, I need to hit right in the middle, and like you're saying, that you're the beginner's whole outlook is, I'm not any good unless I can hit right in the middle.
Yeah.
They're not think like you were saying. They're not thinking about their awareness of their body, their awareness of how they're pulling, you know, the bow back, where the arrow tip is, or anything like that. It's all about. It's an external kind of, it's like an external reference of what my self-worth is. If I can hit the middle, if I can hit the middle, then I'm great. But when you become more experienced and all of a sudden you're not hitting the middle, are you thinking in your brain, well, I'm no good anymore. I'm not a good, and even some people, you know, can go beyond that to, like, well, I'm not a good person anymore because I can't hit the middle of a target. In the Korean, from what I've seen of the kind of, and I know Koreans, it's a national sport in Korea. The number of people that come into the sport is huge. The more people you churn in and out of the sport, you know, just the numbers themselves mean that you're always going to find someone who's going to be good at this. So, but their system, from what I've seen online, is, you know, you don't shoot at a target. They give you a stretch band, and you, if you can't, like, make the movements, they won't give you a bow. If you can't then draw a low poundage bow without an arrow and do it in the kind of way that they want you to do it, you don't get an arrow. And it's, you know, shooting at a target is, and then they go on to, like, blank bail, and then they shoot blank bail for a bit, so that they then eventually, their groups go from being like two, or, you know, a meter wide down to, you know, a 10 centimeter kind of circle in the middle, and then you go on to a target and you've not made all of those negative associations with, well, if I don't hit the middle, I feel bad. And maybe, you know, it's one of those things in life where you need to kind of reassess what your priority is. Is your priority just to hit the middle, and your day at the range, your day in the competition is all about the score? It's all about how many 11s or how many 10s that you got, and nothing else.
I think you're right. And the Korean way of teaching is, I think it's quite good. But in our Western society, I think people are way too eager to, or they are too impatient to take that long draw. It costs to create this body memory, muscle memory, and learn their movements quite right before they actually shoot.
Yeah.
And now I've been teaching a lot in meditation techniques and mindfulness, and we have this thing in mindfulness where you can have your thoughts in the past and in the present moment and in the future. And if you're going to if you're going to feel your body and feel what you're doing, activate your muscle memory in the right way, and at the same time you start to be focusing on the target, and now I need to have this 11 or 10, whatever, then you're actually moving your mindset from the present moment to a future that doesn't exist anymore, and that takes your sensation of the body away. So for me, it's shooting has a lot to do with the meditation as well, because you simply need to be in the present moment and release yourself from this this quest for points, because if you are caught in this point fever, then you are starting to ruin your body memory, and then you're definitely not going to shoot well.
Yeah, there's a thing. I think you were almost on the cusp of kind of saying it before about the difference between the Eastern, the kind of Korean and Western mentality. Is there's a thing in it, and it's very prevalent in the West, is that of instant gratification. It's that you need to have a reward and you need it now.
Yeah.
And that, you know, people saying to you, well, I know I want to shoot at a target, and you're kind of thinking, well, as a coach, I'd rather you learn how to shoot the bow first rather than let's start focusing on we're getting points or arrows in the gold or whatever. And it seems like there is a need. I mean, I'm as guilty of it as anyone else.
But it becomes quite a paradox as well, because when you're in a competition, you actually are competing and need to get these points to win.
Yeah.
But if you are too eager to have these points, then you can't win. So for me, the competitions or the points, or at least I try to do that. Sometimes I get caught, even though that I say here that that's all these things here. But I get caught myself in point fever. But when you are in this, I need to have these points, but I can only get them if I'm in the present moment and real present in myself. Then you get into this paradox, because a competition, you need to have these points.
And it's like you say, it's a paradox. It is a paradox that you need the points to kind of progress through to the next round or to not be eliminated, but you need to not think about it at the same time.
No, and you'll only have these points if you are present and don't think about the points.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think we are in the Western world. We're not being taught that from childhood to have this mindset.
Good segue. Because I was just about to say that there was a study of one of the determining factors in early life for how successful people are, you know, in later life in terms of you know business, sports, academia, is that when young children are given, they did an experiment about young children being given a choice. You can either have one sweet now,
or exactly.
You can wait an hour and we'll give you two or three sweets.
Yeah.
The kids that then just snatch the sweet straight out of the hand without even entertaining the proposition, they're the children that are less likely to be successful, because they can't wait for anything. They have no patience, and it's difficult to learn that later in life. But the kids that can delayed gratification, they can say, okay, if I do this now and I'm patient, I'll get a bigger reward in the future. They're the ones that are more successful, because they can see, if I work hard now, I'm not getting any reward for it now, but there will be a payback at some other time.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, they're the ones, they say, that are able to study better, they're able to train better, they're able to better plan for the future. So, I mean, that's kind of a big circle coming back to, you know, early interactions with archery, yeah, or kind of precision sports or any kind of sport.
And I believe if you take 90% or even more of these top archers, whatever bow they are shooting with, you will see that these persons was the persons who were able as kids to be patient.
Yeah, because you were saying about right at the start, you were saying that archer's reflex. We use that word target panic anymore. Target panic, it conjures up. What I've managed to do is I managed to make a visualization in my head of a target that's got an actual face on it. Like the target becomes, has develops eyes and a nose and a mouth, and it talks and it says, "Please don't shoot at me. Please don't shoot at me." And the target's trying to pull the target pins out so it can escape. So for me, that's what target panic is. The target isn't panicking. People, no. There's no piece of paper has got the kind of emotion and the impulse to try and run away, or any 3D animal. The target is not panicking.
Definitely not.
Unless you're a hunter and you're shooting some kind of beast out there, in which case, if it's sensed that there's an arrow on its way, then it's jumped your string, mate. Sorry.
Yeah.
But you were saying about right at the start about personality. What kind of personality is it? Is it just because I see some people and they're really, really calm. They're like unnervingly calm. I was watching it was a YouTube video, and it had Fred Shoemaker, I think it was, on.
Yeah.
And he was just like the calmest person I have ever listened to. It was almost like soporific. I was almost like my eyes were closing. It was like I was being hypnotized because he was so calm and so kind of reassuring. He was a guy involved in professional golf and teaching, you know, ATP tour, coaching ATP tour people, as well as people whose game was like an absolute, you know, basket case, you know, it had fallen apart. And I guess being a coach, you do need quite a lot of patience, but, you know, you've been to these like big competitions and you've shot alongside archers that are, you know, at world and European level. What kind of personalities are they?
I believe that most people in at least in the longbow division where I have my métier, they are very calm. They are very friendly, and the first time I was participating in the European Championship, one of my now good friends from France, he gave me. I just beated him up with a bow and arrow, and he was the former European champion, and he was just calm and said to me, "Wow, that's good." And just before the final shooting, Sascovino, as is called, he just came to me, and because I was meditating before we were shooting, he came to me and he gave me a little Buddha figure he had around his neck, and then he said, "This year will bring you luck, and France will support you."
He's from France. That's really cool.
And I think that's the mentality in at least the longbow division, and I see it in the other divisions as well. And this way of dealing with your competitors was for me very, very relaxing, because we could have these talks between the targets, and we could be personal. We could and then we could answer this the focus field when you were going to shoot, and then you were on off in the focus, and you were, you had this, or I had at least this at all the competitions I've been to, the sensation of being in a kind of family where people are supporting each other, and these personalities, as you were asking about, in at least the 3D division, are very, very calm, and they are friendly. And I think a lot of them are these who are passionate about the sport and not so eager to win, but more passionate. So if you lose, well, that's just something you have to deal with. It's that's happened. Shit is happening sometimes. But and they just deal with it in a very calm way. So I think, as we were talking about before, this about this experiment with the sweets that were dealt out to the kids, that most of the good shooters they have this patient. But I think also that these people have been talking to the last 20 years in the archery sport. The good ones, they are passionate. They have the passion about the sport, and the competitions are just secondary for most of them. So they have the passion in the practice and the training. It becomes a kind of lifestyle for them. And I think that's where you become good, if you are passionate and you're not so focused on that you need to win the next competition, but you need to practice the right way, and then you'll win the next competition. And again, just when we are standing with the bow in full draw and starting to think about I need to have this 10 or 11, then you move away from the present moment. I think it's a little the same with these persons. They are able to become present in the practice, become present in their passionate life for archery.
I sent a thank you to somebody on Messenger the other day who's a top guy in the US. He's just won a big indoor competition. And he's there, he wants to win. I'm sure he does. I'm sure he enjoys going there and shooting and meeting all the people, because it seems like it's a bit of, as well as being an archery event, it's like part of the kind of bare bow, you know, non-sight kind of single string, you know, family of archers. And there seems to be a big social scene there, but at the same time, you know, he's obviously practicing a lot. He's, you know, at home. You know, it obviously eats into his kind of social life and his family time. But he was there, and was part of a presentation that put on a discussion about it was about target panic. Despite appearances that quite a lot of the time I talk about it, I was just interested to see what their approach was, because their approach is very different from that of Joel Turner. They're talking about, I mean, Joel Turner talks about separating the shot, but that wasn't that conversation. It was just, I just sent them a message just to say thanks for doing that. And thanks, they posted a thing. It was like a bow tuning seminar, and like, there's a lot of like carryover. You know, a lot of club coaches, especially here, they're not well up on bare bow or flat bow, long bow, whatever. So in terms of getting a bow set up for a beginner, they're just bringing what they think they know from recurve archery, which it's not the same. It's just not the same at all. Especially if you're string walking. If you're string walking in barebow, it's just completely different from Olympic recurve.
It is.
The bow's only in tune at one particular crawl on the string. The rest of it is the tune's completely different.
Totally out of tune.
You know, and having arrows that are on the edge of being in tune, which work at a certain crawl, but once you get past that, they're acting, even fully fletched with say 5-inch feathers on, they're still acting weird. That's not something that Olympic recurve deal with, as far as I can see.
No, so, and we have a lot of differences when we are anchoring at the face.
Yeah.
Because the angles in the shoulders, I've been teaching in anatomy once for physiotherapist students, and the angle in the shoulders and our whole body, when you flip your head a little over the arrow to get the right side picture, so the arrow is just vertical below the side eye, it's very this setup, the body setup is very different from the recurve archers, the Olympic recurve archers. So we have a lot of differences, but when you are about to release the string and are doing that, then we are into the same game again.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, yeah, and this thing, we're running quite long, and I didn't want to keep you more than an hour, but we are running quite long. I am enjoying the chat as well. So,
yeah.
Just in terms of this shot separation, I mean, I'm still trying to figure out how to separate the aim, and then, like you were saying, you need to become more aware. But at the same time, you've got this paradox of, like, you know, you might need to get a 10 to stay in the competition, to progress to the next round.
The first thing I think you have to do when you have the archer's reflex and you are caught in these things, you have to be very curious about what you're doing instead of slapping yourself in the head. About the things you're doing, so be curious about it. So the first thing is to stop nagging yourself. So the curiosity will become a good friend in this decoding or suppressing the reflex, and meditating with there's a lot of different meditations. But become more aware about how you are dealing with life, everyday life things. Are you able to, like, be present when you are doing the dishes, cooking food, whatever? Then you can use these daily life things as a training part for your archery, because then you can start moving your mind back to the present moment, and by doing that and by becoming more curious about what you are doing and not slapping yourself in the face when you're doing wrong, just become curious and now I'm very close to my trigger point or to this trigger mechanism I activated there. I'm very close. Next time I can get a little closer, and next time maybe a little closer. And then you start by the curiosity to become closer and closer, or to get closer and closer to the place where the trigger mechanism are activated. And suddenly you realize that by the things I have talked about at my YouTube channel, suddenly you realize that you're able to get control closer and closer to the place where your reflex are activated. And suddenly you can control it. But it takes a lot of time and the approach where you actually are curious instead of angry with yourself. That approach, for me at least, and others I have been working with for disastrous reflex or to suppress it, they found out that that joy with archery was increased because it wasn't suddenly a struggle anymore. It became a joy because the curiosity was the part that that was in the lead for them, and not the angriness towards yourself.
Yeah, that chimes along with some of the stuff I've read in these kind of golf and tennis books on coaching, where, you know, you have to become curious and completely non-judgmental. You need to not judge what you're doing. And like I said at the start, like the only constant in my kind of shot I hate using myself as any kind of reference. But the only constant was the fact that it was changing all the time. And that kind of, there was always a voice that, oh, try this.
Yeah.
And it becomes a thing where, well, no, that didn't work. Try this. And it just becomes this thing where you're just constantly chasing your tail. But at the same time, you start to judge and you get frustrated.
Yeah.
And frustration's like, it's just the kind of stress of things not being the way that you want them to be, and not accepting the way that they are. One thing you were talking about, meditation and then using other things. One thing that I really like the idea of, but I did it kind of, it was completely unplanned. It was more of a subconscious thing. So I'd been toying with the idea of trying a triggered shot, a la Joel Turner with a clicker or a sear or whatever. But I was like determined that I could beat this. And this all came about after I shot a national indoor competition. I'd never shot less than 500 in competition. I tell a lie, I shot 494 the first time I did an 18-meter world archery round. I'd always shot above 500. And then basically this one, the weeks leading up to it, well, the months leading up to it, my shooting had just been getting worse. And then it kind of, I'd have a real up, and then I'd have a real down, and then a bit of an up, and then it would just be down. And then it was almost like every session, even in practice, that it was always just bad. It was just awful. And then I shot this competition. It was the worst I've ever shot. I was like 70 points below my average for competition.
Oh,
not 70 points below my PB, but 70 points below my competition average. I was 100 points below my PB in practice. So it was a real fall off a cliff. So at that point, I was like, I sold literally all of my stuff, because one of the crutches that I used was, as well as constantly changing my shot, I was constantly changing equipment. And that, I became like a compound archer who has literally like a bag with 20 releases. And as soon as they have a bad shot, they reach in their bag for another release, and they get five or six arrows of relief. Until their brain's gone, I know this one, right, let's start throwing the arrows everywhere. And then they reach in and they grab another release. Sorry, compound archers, if you're listening, I know that's kind of a stereotype, but we'll go with it. But what had happened that build up to that is that every time I touched the bow, or every time I went to do a shooting session, there was a negative association with it. And like you were talking before about a spiral, like things can, like, you know, when you need to get those points and your adrenaline gets up, and then you get, you know, your shooting goes down, and then your adrenaline goes up, and it becomes this like death spiral. That I just kind of got, again, I hate talking about myself.
that is why I say that, sorry, that is why I say that you have to build up curiosity so you can reframe your joy about archery, so you build in these positive associations with the bow. And I have done a lot of you can call it self hypnosis meditations, where you make a mental anchor to your bow, where you
that's
are
where I was going with this
visualizing.
You've segued again straight into it. That's where I was going, because you've got this little meditation stroke hypnosis thing of grabbing your bow, and you explain. I mean, it's your little thing that you do.
But it's a meditation or self hypnosis part where you sit with your bow, and you have a firm grip around your bow handle, and you imagine this excellent shot that you have been performing. Once in your life, or maybe more than once, and you start to visualize this shooting you have been doing there, at some place where you have been doing this shot, and when you are visualizing, your brain actually doesn't know that you're not doing the thing if you are becoming good at visualizing. And you start to micro-activate your muscles at the same time when you are doing these visualizations. And these micro-activations and the mental anchor to this good shot that you have made are connected to the sensation in your palm.
So you're saying
that touch your bow.
You need to hold your bow, the bow that you shoot a competition with, the bow that you shoot like all the time.
Yeah.
And you need to hold that, and then you need to think like
you need to hold it and feel this handle, and imagine or visualizing this very very good shot that you have made. And when you start to visualize your shooting and your sensation of the release and the arrow just hitting the middle of the target, and then you open your eyes, and I'm guiding all this in the video, or in the visualization I've made. But then you start open your eyes and you look around in the room where you are sitting, and you're looking at a thing. It could be a picture or whatever, and you name this thing aloud for yourself, just aloud out in the room, and then you close your eyes again, and you feel the bow handle, and you start visualizing this shot again. By doing this, you start to create a mental anchor that you can, so to say, go down in your subconscious mind and pick up. So every time you touch your bow or touch this bow handle, you will have a clear sensation of this shot, and you will start to feel this joy again.
So
when you're shooting.
So you've got to grip the bow, and you've got to make that association, that link with your hand being on the grip of the bow. That positive visualization, name the visualization.
Yeah.
And then just open your eyes and go back to it again, and then feel all of that happening as like
and
an automatic.
By opening your eyes when you're doing this visualization and start to look around in the room, then you get present and you get away from the subconscious mind. The visualization, and then you go back again. So you start to create this memory path or a path to this specific situation where you have a very very good shot, and it's combined with the sensation of the bow in your hand. So when you take this bow in your hand afterwards, you have done this visualization a lot of times, then you will start to remember this shot every time. And when you remember the shot, then you already have this good sensation about shooting.
I kind of came about this not by doing the kind of visualization, which I have seen that. That's another thing. If people want to look at it on your YouTube channel, it's it's J-E-S. It's L-Y-S-G-A-R-D. Is that correct?
G-A-A-R-D.
Just look for Archer's Reflex. But there is this visualization stroke meditation stroke self-hypnosis. There's an exercise on there, isn't there, for it?
Yeah.
I came about this just because I was then determined I need to do some bow drills. I need to get control of my form. I need to get control of my shot process.
Yeah.
And then I need to get comfortable having my arrow tip near the middle of the gold or on the middle of the gold. And I literally did like 6 weeks of drills. I didn't shoot a single arrow. I did four or 5 weeks of draw hold. So pulling the bow back. And then for 10 seconds, I had a timer on my phone next to me, and that gave me a 10 seconds and then a countdown ready to come down, and then a 10 second interval and then back up again. But that broke that negativity of always having a bad session, always having problems, always having uncontrolled shots. And it kind of I don't think it's necessarily broken it permanently. I think, like you say, all of those bad situations are kind of stored, yeah. And at, you know, a time when you're under pressure, when your adrenaline's up, they may come back out. But just doing the bow drills and then moving on to blind bail shooting and blank bail shooting, the shot just felt so much better, and it became, yeah. like you were saying, the word joy. It became like a joy to just go out. I mean, I have not shot an arrow past 5 meters since December, the beginning of December, and yeah. we're now almost at March. So I've not shot any further than 5 meters for 3 months. So I have still enjoyed doing that, which kind of says, well, you know, why would I just want to give up? I actually enjoy just standing there and releasing an arrow. It's that to me still
and that's good. Fine.
Yeah,
that's just fine, because who tells you that you need to do different?
Yeah, yeah, and that's another thing. You know, a lot of the stuff that you know how to do, if you're not aware, if you don't have awareness, if you're not curious about what's going on, you're never going to learn it. You're never going to. People can stand there and say, do this, do that.
Yeah.
But you don't know why you're doing it. And if you're not aware of that you're doing it wrong, then you can't be aware that you're doing it right. If you see what I mean.
No, that's where the conscious part there enters the scene, because that's one of my darlings, actually. If you're not knowing what you're doing and conscious about it, then you are simply not able to correct it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And as you said before, this is about changing the whole time, changing the bow, changing the arrow, changing the string, whatever. I think you have to be so patient about that you and changing the method as well. You have to cling with one method and get into that method, and then when you have learned that method deeply enough, then you can say if it works, and it might take half a year or something before you know that. Yeah. So if you switch the bow, switch the method, and the coach as well, if you switch the coach, the thing the coach says the whole time, then you will never be able to have a solid foundation of your shooting. And I'm a pragmatic person, so what works, and despite what it is that works, if it works for you, it works. So I'm not so dogmatic in what you're actually doing, as long as it works for you.
Well, that's really cool. That's a good way to end it. That's a good way to end the podcast. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I would actually like to end the podcast with a quote from one of my favorite pop groups, a Swedish pop group called First Aid Kit. They have a song called Emilu. It's like a little country music, but she sings in that song, "As much I know, things don't grow if you don't bless them with your patience."
Yeah, you need to be patient, and you need to kind of stick with something for a while, like you said. You need to stick with something for a while and just see, live with it, feel it, work with it, and then see after, say, 6 to 12 months, see if it works. It's a long process.
Yeah, it is. But then it will start to pay off if you're patient.
Wise words, brilliant. Thank you very much for coming on. It was a very short notice.
Yeah, you're welcome. It was a pleasure. Have a nice day then.
Yeah, cheers.
Yeah, cheers. Bye-bye.